Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as the News and Observer, The Week magazine, The Independent, New York Times, Rolling Stone, ClassicBands.com, and Entertainment Weekly. This opening number is brought to us by a group called The Broken Bells. Name of it is The High Road. Thanks to Dr. J, not the basketball player, but a local person who recommended this group. We'll be hearing more about and from Broken Bells later on in today's program, and they'll close out today's program as well. But first, these trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from ClassicBands.com. Question number one. Which famous rock and roll star's real name is Giles Perry Richardson? What is his stage name? And question number two, which famous rock star's real name is Robert Zimmerman? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. The transition section of today's program is brought to us by BGORecords.com. Today in rock history, and today is June 5 and June 6. What were the number one hits back in history? Well, back in 1961, you may remember, Roy Orbison had the number one hit this weekend on Running Scared. And back in 1965, 4 years later, it was the Sound of Music soundtrack, which was number one on June the 5th. Paul McCartney back in 1971 had the number one hit, Ram, back on June the 5th. And 1982, Roxy Music, Avalon was number one on June the 5th. Now, if you were born on June the 5th, you share a birthday with Bill Hayes. He did the Ballad of Davy Crockett. He was born on that day back in 1928. And Freddie Stone of Sly and the Family Stone was born on that day back in 1946. And finally born on June 5th was Mark Wahlberg, a.k.a. Marky Mark. And he was born on that day back in 1971. Miscellany in rock history back in 1954 on this day, it was Billboard magazine reports that from July, major record labels will supply radio DJs with 45s instead of 78s. That was back in 54 on this day. Back in 59 on this day, 5 years later, Bob Dylan graduates from Hibbing High School, Minnesota. And back in 1971 on this day, it was Grand Funk Railroad break the Beatles' money record as their Shea Stadium show sells out in 72 hours, making $306,000. Also on June the 5th, back in 1976, 5 years after that, Rolling Stones become the first group to receive record royalties from the USSR when copyright laws are changed. And finally, on June 5th, back in 1977, you may remember this important news event, Alice Cooper's boa constrictor is fatally bitten by the live rat it was being fed for breakfast. And what about June the 6th? Well, the number one hits on June the 6th, back in 1964, was the Dixie Cups with Chapel of Love. And back in 1972, it was Jethro Tull, Thick as a Brick. And finally, back in 1992, on June the 6th, the number one hit was Lionel Richie, Back to Front. If you were born on June the 6th, you share a birthday with Levy Stubbs of the Four Tops. He was born on that day, back in 1936. And back in 1939 on that day, June the 6th, Gary U.S. Bonds, quarter to three. And finally, Peter Albin, big brother in the holding company, was born on June the 6th, 1944. In rock miscellany history, we see back in 1956 on June the 6th, Bebop-a-Lula by Gene Vincent is released. And back in 1962, the Beatles began their first demo recordings for EMI at Abbey Road Studios. Back in 1970 on June the 6th, Joni Mitchell hits the UK LP chart for the first time with Ladies of the Canyon. Back in 1971, John and Yoko joined Frank Zappa on stage at Fillmore East in New York. Also in 1971, on June the 6th, Gladys Knight and the Pips star on the last Ed Sullivan Show. Back in 82, first of a week of peace gigs begins when Stevie Wonder, Jackson Browne, Tom Petty and others play to 85,000 in Los Angeles for Peace Sunday. And back in 1987 on this day, Herb Albert hits the top 10 at number 9 in the U.S. with Diamonds, 24 and a half years after his first top hit with Lonely Bull. And finally, back in 1992 on this date, the Broadway musical Tommy wins 5 Tony Awards. Pete Townshend wins award for Best Original Score. This final transitions piece is brought to us by Wayne Perry of the Associated Press, published on May the 16, 2010. Metal legend Ronnie James Dio, dead at 67. Ronnie James Dio, whose soaring vocals, poetic lyrics, and mythic tales of a never-ending struggle between good and evil, broke new ground in heavy metal, died Sunday, according to a statement from his wife and manager. He was 67. Dio revealed last summer that he was suffering from stomach cancer shortly after wrapping up a tour in Atlantic City, New Jersey, with the latest incarnation of Black Sabbath under the name Heaven and Hell. "Today my heart is broken," Wendy Dio wrote on the singer's site, adding he died at 7:45 a.m. Many, many friends and family were able to say their private goodbyes before he peacefully passed away. "Ronnie knew how much he was loved by all," Wendy Dio continued. "We so appreciate the love and support that you have all given us. Please know he loved you all, and his music will live on forever." The statement was confirmed by Los Angeles publicist Maureen O'Connor. Dio was being treated at a Houston hospital, according to his site. Though Dio had recently undergone his 7th chemotherapy treatment, he was hopeful to perform again. Earlier this month, Heaven and Hell canceled its summer tour, but Dio did not view being sidelined as a permanent thing. "Wendy, my doctors, and I worked so hard to make it happen for all of you, the ones we care so much about, that this setback could be devastating, but we will not let it be," he said in a statement. "With your continued love and support, we will carry on and thrive. There will be other tours, more music, more life, and much more magic." Dio rose to fame in 1975 as the first lead singer of Rainbow, the heavy metal band put together by guitarist Ritchie Blackmore, who had just quit Deep Purple. Dio then replaced legendary vocalist Ozzy Osbourne in Black Sabbath in 1980 with a critically acclaimed album, Heaven and Hell, considered by many critics to be one of the finest heavy metal albums of all time. His on-again, off-again tenure with Black Sabbath touched off an intense debate among fans as to which singer was the true essence of the band, a discussion that lasted until his death. The article skips down. Many of his most memorable songs revolved around the struggle between good and evil, including his signature tune, Heaven and Hell. He also drew heavily on medieval imagery in songs like Neon Nights, Killing the Dragon, and Stargazer. "He possessed one of the greatest voices in all of heavy metal and had a heart to match it," said Twisted Sister guitarist J.J. French, whose band toured with Dio since 1983, and was to do so again this summer at European rock festivals. "He was the nicest, classiest person you would ever want to meet." Dio organized an all-star charity collaboration in 1986 called Hear and Aid to raise money for famine relief in Africa, styled on the successful We Are the World campaign of a few years earlier. His solo hits included Rainbow in the Dark, The Last in Line, and Holy Diver. In local rock news, we see this story entitled Live from Kuwait. local musician performs for U.S. troops as part of Operation MySpace. This article was written by Brian Howe for The Independent. What do Jessica Simpson, Filter, Disturbed, Pussycat Dolls, Metal Seance, and Carlos Mencia have in common? Until recently, not much. Simpson and Pussycat Dolls are bootylicious pop stars. Filter and Disturbed are heavy guitar bands. Metal Sanez is an ambiguous internet celebrity. And Carlos Mencia is a comedian. But these diverse acts became unlikely Barracks Fellows last month, courtesy of social networking site MySpace and its parent company, Fox. Operation MySpace sent them all to Kuwait to perform for American troops stationed at a military base there. The mass media powerhouse, not known for halfway measures, turned the performances into the first-ever high-definition webcast. While most of us can only witness this surreal desert mashup of American popular culture via screens, one Carrboro resident, Mitchell Marlowe, got to experience it firsthand. Marlowe has a neat faux hawk, lots of colorful tattoos, rectangular glasses, and an easygoing manner of speech. He grew up in Hillsboro, picking up the skateboard and the guitar in elementary school. Locally, Marlowe is probably best known as one of the proprietors of Warrior Sound Studio, although some know him as a veteran of local bands like Regatta 69, Blank Face, and He Is Legal, or Legend. 3 months ago, Marlowe joined Filter as a guitarist. Filter had some hits as a mainstream industrial act in the 1990s. You'll most likely remember the band from the seething Nine Inch Nails-style single, Hey Man, Nice Shot. After moving forward a more alterna-rock style, Filter dissolved around 2002, but reunited last year. Joining Filter wasn't Marlowe's first brush with fame. When Wes Borland left rap metal band Limp Bizkit, the band invited Marlowe to join. He declined. Their manager also managed Michelle Branch, who had a thing for, Marlowe recalls. I joked with him that I would join Limp Bizkit if he'd get me a date with her. The next day he called back with Michelle Branch on speakerphone, but I was too nervous to say much. Marlowe owes these connections in large part to his time living in New York City, playing with the band Sound of Speed. He characterizes Sound of Speed as an industry buzz band. No one in the general public knew about us, but we were a band to watch in all these industry magazines, so I met a lot of people. The article skips down. After a month of rehearsals and one small tour, Marlowe decamped for Kuwait with Filter. He spent 3 days on base. It was hot as hell, and I didn't get much to see outside the base, he says. His time was spent rehearsing, going on ersatz training missions and chatting with the troops. He took a helicopter ride over the desert, got photographed with Kuwaiti royalty, and fired a grenade launcher at a virtual reality screen. It was like a big video game, remembers Marlowe, who characterizes his position on the war as complicated, and says he's still undecided about it. Marlowe got to know a lot of the male performers, he said, but the females, all bona fide pop stars, were less approachable. They were always mobbed with cameras and people, he says, like something you'd see in L.A., but in the desert. Everyone was in shorts, and they would show up with all this fancy hair and makeup. There was a Starbucks on base, and I was hanging out there talking to some photographers. Then Simpson walked in, and all of a sudden, I'm getting pushed aside. The performance took place in an on-base amphitheater. Marlowe says the troops were appreciative and enjoyed the remainder of home, watching them dance. I was like, man, I bet they haven't done that forever. We ate in the mess halls with them and talked to them a lot, he remembers. Mostly they asked us about things going on in the States and talked about how they couldn't wait to get home. This article was published in The Independent on April the 9th, 2008. This next article was published in NewsObserver.com on May the 3rd, 2010. Pop songs feel the Glee effect. Los Angeles. Steve Perry was skeptical when the producers of a TV pilot about a high school glee club sought permission to use his band's signature song in their show. The former frontman for the classic rock group Journey is protective of his legacy. I want to be able to put these songs somewhere with good conscience that they're not going to be abused, Perry says, and I don't want to see that happen. He needn't have worried. Perry overcame his doubts, agreed to license the song to the producers of Fox's Glee, and a year later, Don't Stop Believin' has reached a new generation of music fans. As many younger viewers seem to be losing interest in the once invulnerable American Idol, Glee looks poised to be pop's new tastemaker. Much like Idol, Glee is helping alter the dynamic between music and television, showing ways that both media can help prop each other up in a world beset by multi-channel and internet competition. Returning from a four-month hiatus, the first-season comedy about nerdy Glee Club members hit a ratings peak following American Idol, with 13.6 million total viewers. It beat Idol among the key demographic of adults aged 18 to 34, according to the Nielsen Company. It's music that drives the show, and the show drives music sales. On Monday, the three cast albums were number 1, 7, and 10 on Apple's iTunes album chart, and together have sold more than 1 million units, according to SoundScan. Sales of the cast singles, which typically are released shortly after an episode airs, have logged online sales of 4.1 million. The show's covers also are sending the original recordings back up the charts. Perhaps most crucially, Glee, like Idol, is bridging the gap between classic rock favored by boomers and hip-hop popular with their kids. Old songs are new. Perry said he loved the Glee version of Don't Stop Believing. They really worked hard to make it their own, he said. It's actually brought people's attention to go check out the original. It's something I never thought I'd see in my lifetime. The travails of the music business are well documented, but the truth is, a good idea can cut through that, said Rob Stringer, the chairman of Sony Music Label Group, which releases the Glee cast music. I think Glee's an example. Creator Ryan Murphy claims to be guided by instinct and musical nostalgia in picking songs that run the gamut. 70s balladeer Eric Carmen, R&B diva Jill Scott, and show tunes from Cabaret and Wicked. So what do you know about this featured artist, Broken Bells, that opened today's program? And we'll close it as well. Heather Ferries writes this biography of Broken Bells, published on May the 13th, 2010, in BarnesandNoble.com. Though Broken Bells featured two of the bigger names in Indian alternative music, The Shins singer-guitarist James Mercer and producer, multi-instrumentalist, Brian Burton, a.k.a. Danger Mouse, the duo managed to keep their project secret for a relatively long time. The pair were inspired to collaborate when they met at 2004's Roskilde Music Festival in Denmark, where they discovered they were fans of each other's work. However, they didn't start writing and recording together as a band until March 2008, when Mercer holed up in Burton's home studio in Los Angeles. The duo took a different approach to their work together than they had with their other projects. Burton avoided the sample-heavy style he used on the Grey album and Beck's Modern Guilt and played only live instruments, while Mercer broadened his vocal style to include falsettos and deeper registers. Mercer and Burton announced that they were Broken Bells in fall of 2009, and late that year they released their debut single, The High Road. Their self-titled debut album arrived in spring 2010. The High Road, by the way, was the number that opened today's program. Also, this biography written by Last.fm, and it says, Broken Bells is an indie rock duo which formed in 2009. The band consists of James Mercer, vocals and guitar, and Brian Danger Mouse Burton, multiple instruments and production. Mercer is a member of the indie rock band The Shins, and Burton is a member of Gnarls Barkley and Danger Doom, as well as being a respected producer for such artists as Beck, Gorillaz, The Rapture, and The Black Keys. A debut self-titled album by Broken Bells was released on Columbia Records on March 9, 2010. The first single from the record, The High Road, was released on December 21, 2009. Also, this was published in the script for All Things Considered back on March 16, 2010. Melissa Block, the host. Broken Bells, Danger Mouse meets James Mercer. Melissa Block writes, "Today, a musical mashup. We're going to hear what happens when you blend the sounds of indie rocker James Mercer with those of musician and producer Brian Burton, also known as Danger Mouse." Block says, "There are tons of layers on these songs, but you've made a point of saying that this is not sampled, that all the recording was done live in the studio." Mr. Burton, "Yes." Mr. Mercer, "Right. Some of it sounds sampled because of how we treated it, but yeah, it's all performed there." Block, "And that's important to you?" Mr. Mercer, "It's more fun." Mr. Burton, "Yeah, and I think the control that you have when you do that, if you decide you want to go left at this one moment, you don't have to interrupt. You can change the chord. You can do whatever you want on it. I think for us, this was definitely more about the song writing and making cool songs that, you know, could just be played on a guitar or a piano or something, and then all the other stuff was just really for fun, and sonically, too, that had a lot of our influence in it." Block, "Let's listen to one of the songs. This is Sailing to Nowhere." Mr. Burton, "This is a Wurlitzer with an acoustic guitar, and then it changes over to this really psychedelic kind of, it's drums and Hammond organ, yeah, I kind of meant for it to sound like it was this inserted piece from somewhere else, maybe." Block, "There are lots of shades. I think of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band in here, right?" Mr. Mercer, "I hear that now. I hear that now that you've said that, but I hadn't before." Mr. Burton, "I mean, the idea that these things could be, there could be all these changes and go here and go there, that's great, you know? I mean, we obviously love the Beatles and we really wanted to make something that had our influences in them for sure, you know, but still sounds like it's just James and there's still, I guess, me in there somewhere." Block, "What's happening at the end of this song? We're hearing sort of crowd sound. I think there's a train, somebody whistling." Mr. Mercer, I pictured it as, Mr. Burton, "as a harbor, right?" Mr. Mercer, "Yes, I pictured it as the final sort of docking of this ship on which something disastrous has happened." Mr. Burton, "Yeah." Mr. Mercer, "There's a story about a ship coming into harbor in the 1340s, bringing the plague to Europe. These sailors showed up, and they were in a horrible state. They had black apple-sized goiters on their body. I mean, it was the beginning of the end of, I guess, half of the population of Europe, right?" Block, "Now, is that what you were thinking about when you wrote that song, or is that just you vented after the fact?" Mr. Mercer, "It's imagery that, while we were working on it, was going through my head." Block, "There are a bunch of times on the album where James's vocals are sort of folded way back in this cushion of layered sound." Block, "And I'm wondering if at a point for you, Brian, maybe the lyrics became less important as words and as meaning and really more as another instrument or another kind of texture that you're folding in." Mr. Burton, "Maybe. I think James's voice is definitely the lead instrument on this album. It's a good thing, I think, and I think it's important for when you're listening to music that when you're hearing it, you don't really picture the people making it. Instead, you picture something else visually, whether it's outer space or whether it's an island full of people or you traveling along with a girl somewhere or a guy somewhere or something. Whatever it is that comes to your mind based on what the music is doing is, that's much more important to me as opposed to hearing something." Mr. Mercer, "Literal meaning, Mr. Burton. Yeah, or somebody sitting there with a guitar singing to you. It's important that you're able to take this album and let it be a part of your life, whether it's in the background or whether you really want to put on headphones and listen to every little part of it." The interview skips down with references to the tracks Mongrel Heart and The Mall and Misery and ends with this. Block, "Together, James Mercer and Brian Burton are Broken Bells. At our website, you can hear Broken Bells' new album in its entirety, and tomorrow night, you can hear them live in concert from South by Southwest. That's nprmusic.org. This is NPR. So let's listen to some snippets in from this album. We'll start out with Sailing to Nowhere, which was reviewed in the article just heard. Now we'll listen to a snippet from a song called Citizen.
This is a day without a trace of reason. No matter where you turn, and the walls will fall, affirming nothing. So what's it all about?
And now we'll listen to a snippet from their song, Trapdoors. Once again, we're limited from playing too much of the song because of copyright laws. We'll end up today's program, however, with their song, October. Once again, Broken Bells. This album review is brought to us by The Week, April the 2nd, 2010. Jimi Hendrix, Valleys of Neptune, given 3 stars. Jimi Hendrix has enjoyed quite the afterlife, says Keith Phipps in the AV Club. Since the guitar virtuoso's death in 1970 at age 27, hundreds of posthumous recordings from his estate have surfaced. So many, in fact, that this latest might easily be overlooked. But it shouldn't be, said Greg Cott in the Chicago Tribune. Recorded in 1969, just before bassist Noel Redding left the band, Valleys of Neptune offers a sharp snapshot of a musical genius in the studio during a period of transition. So how'd you do on the trivia question? Which famous rock star's real name is Giles Perry Richardson? That was, of course, the Big Bopper. And which famous rock star's real name is Robert Zimmerman? That is, of course, Bob Dylan. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until... Next time.